This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 21st of March, 2008. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.
I told him that I was sorry, and I told him that I myself would be very disturbed if I learned that somebody had looked into my passport file.
The State Department reveals that Clinton's, Obama's, and McCain's passport records have been breached, while Obama picks up another key endorsement.
Este es un hombre que nos entiende y nos va a respetar.
We'll preview tomorrow's presidential elections in Taiwan, where campaigning has been marked by the conflict in Tibet.
You know, it reminds a lot of Taiwanese of the old days, where the Taiwanese language was also discriminated here in our own homeland.
And a private investment firm's redevelopment plan threatens to displace some 6,000 mostly Latino residents in LA. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was in northern India today to meet with the Dalai Lama and others in the Tibetan exile community. Pelosi called the ongoing situation in Tibet a challenge to the conscience of the world. The Chinese ambassador to India described her visit as meddling in China's internal affairs. Meanwhile, Indian police arrested at least 20 Tibetan protesters today after they barged onto the grounds of the Chinese embassy in New Delhi. Some of the protesters scaled the compound walls to hang Tibetan flags and protest signs calling for a boycott of the Beijing Olympics. In other news, the White House has authorized military aid to Kosovo in a move that has angered Serbia and Russia. Amy Miller has more from Belgrade.
Russia today called for an urgent meeting of NATO members to discuss the Bush administration's approval of military aid to Kosovo. The American president signed the measure on Wednesday, stating that arms shipment to Kosovo would, quote, strengthen the security of the United States and promote world peace. Serbia and Russia argue that UN Security Council Resolution 1244 prohibits any military aid to Kosovo other than to UN forces in the region. Serbia and Russia, both opponents of Kosovo's declaration of independence, say that the supply of weapons to the region will further destabilize the situation and create the potential for violence. Russian envoy to NATO, Dmitry Rogozin, was quoted as saying giving weapons to former Kosovo's Liberation Army terrorists for the war against terrorism is, if nothing else, interesting. Throughout the 1990s, the United States and the United Nations listed the KLA as a terrorist organization. The KLA's former leader, Hasim Thaci, is currently Kosovo's prime minister. For FSRN, I'm Amy Miller in Belgrade.
The leaders of the divided island of Cyprus met today to relaunch peace talks. The Mediterranean island has been partitioned between Greek and Turkish-influenced areas since 1974, with the United Nations maintaining a peacekeeping force in the buffer zone. Negotiations between the two sides have been stalled for the past 4 years. The Greek Cypriot government is recognized internationally as the sovereign authority over the island, while only Turkey recognizes the authority of the Turkish Cypriot government in the north. The newly seated president of the Republic of Cyprus ran on a platform of reunification. The two leaders have agreed to open a barrier in the capital city, Nicosia, as a gesture of goodwill. Many political analysts view today's meeting as a first step towards reuniting the divided island. Back in the U.S., a North Carolina teenager is the latest person to die from a taser. 17-year-old Daryl Turner was reportedly arguing with his supervisor at a grocery store in Charlotte when police arrived on the scene. The police department released a statement saying that the officer used the taser after Turner threw an object at the supervisor. Charlotte police will conduct an internal investigation to determine if the officer followed procedure. Turner's mother told local television that authorities did not notify her of her son's death. She had to find out from his co-workers what had happened. And finally, a California court has ordered Starbucks to pay $105 million to its California coffee shop workers after the company was found in violation of the law for its policy of allowing shift supervisors to take a cut of the tip jar. Andrew Stelzer reports.
A San Diego Superior Court judge ruled in favor of 120,000 current and former California Starbucks baristas in the class action suit. The $105 million represents the estimated sum of tips they missed out on from October 2000 through February 2008. Under California law, owners, managers, or other so-called agents of a business owner cannot share tips. The court ruled that shift supervisors fall into this category and therefore shouldn't be sharing pooled tips with regular employees.
It is a way to compensate the supervisors out of a source other than Starbucks' own pocket.
Laura Ho is an attorney who represented the Starbucks baristas.
If Starbucks wanted to compensate shift supervisors at a higher level, there are lots of ways to do that. The one way they couldn't do that is taking the money from the tip pool with the baristas. And we would hope that Starbucks responds by paying supervisors more for the supervising work that they do instead of using tips to compensate supervisors.
Judge Patricia Cowett said she will also issue an injunction immediately preventing Starbucks from continuing to pay supervisors out of the tip jar at its more than 2,000 coffee shops in California. Starbucks has vowed to appeal the ruling and will seek to postpone the injunction during the appeals process, which may take up to 2 years. For FSRN, from Oakland, California, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The State Department comes under fire as it reveals that passport records of Senators Barack Obama, John McCain, and Hillary Clinton were all accessed without authorization within the past year. Although the investigation is ongoing, two of the persons involved have been fired. In more campaign news, New Mexico's Governor Bill Richardson formally endorsed Barack Obama at a rally in Oregon today. Richardson said Obama started a discussion on race within the nation that, quote, was long overdue. FSRN's Catherine Jarmul has more in this week's Political News Roundup.
Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John McCain have more in common than presidential dreams. Each was the victim of privacy violations by State Department employees. Each candidate's passport file was viewed without authorized access by employees. Two contractors and one department employee viewed Obama and McCain's records. The two contractors were terminated, but the employee who accessed the records is still working, but no longer has access, according to State Department spokesman Sean McCormick. Clinton's records were accessed by an employee during training in 2007. McCormick said the trainee completed the instruction program without another incident. The inspector general is still investigating the unauthorized access. At a press conference today, McCormick said the system worked, despite the repeated breaches.
Yeah, I do feel like the system worked. And we do feel like the system worked, but the system isn't perfect. And what you do in these kinds of circumstances is you learn. People at the working level did the right things. They confronted these employees who had accessed these files in an unauthorized way, and they took action. That was the right thing to do, and that's by the book. What didn't happen is that information didn't rise up to senior management levels so that we could be made aware of it. That should have happened.
McCormick said he first became aware of the access when contacted by a reporter about it Thursday afternoon. He said that there are millions of authorized and official accesses of records and only, quote, a handful of unauthorized accesses every year. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice told CNN today that it was a success that the necessary checks alerted management that the violation occurred, but explained that internal processes went wrong. She expressed her concern to Senator Obama during a recent phone call.
I told him that I was sorry, and I told him that I myself would be very disturbed if I learned that somebody had looked into my passport file, and therefore I will stay on top of it, get to the bottom of it.
The State Department has not released the names of the employees or what information was reviewed. According to McCormick, the department places flags on high-profile records, alerting office management when files are viewed without proper reason. In other campaign-related news, Bill Richardson announced his support for Barack Obama today at a campaign rally in Oregon, calling him, quote, a once-in-a-lifetime leader. The endorsement of Obama comes despite Richardson's history with the Clintons. Richardson was the Secretary of Energy and the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations under Bill Clinton. Richardson ended his own presidential bid on January 10th, 2 days after the New Hampshire primary. He is also a superdelegate for the Democratic Party. In his endorsement speech today, Richardson called Obama's speech in Philadelphia regarding race in the United States a, quote, historic speech.
As a Hispanic American, I was particularly touched by his words. Este es un hombre que nos entiende y nos va a respetar.
Richardson may bring Obama increased support from Latino voters. The United States' only Latino governor, Richardson was born in California but spent much of his youth in Mexico City. Up to this point, Clinton has been a favorite among Latino voters, according to exit polls. Richardson also addressed the issue of immigration in his endorsement speech.
I've been troubled by the demonization of immigrants, specifically Hispanics, by too many in this country. Hate crimes against Hispanics are rising as a direct result, and now, in tough economic times, people look for scapegoats, and I fear that people will continue to exploit our racial differences and place them on others not like them. We all know the real culprit, the disastrous economic policies of the Bush administration.
Calling him mi buen amigo, Richardson said he and Obama both come from immigrant backgrounds and both understand the importance of that identity in America today. Obama commended Richardson's career and campaign, saying he was honored that Richardson supports him as the next president. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel in Washington, D.C.
Presidential elections will be held in Taiwan Saturday. After 8 years of ruling by the Democratic Progressive Party, the Nationalist Party was set up to take the lead. But the unrest in Tibet has marked the last days of campaigning, making the outcome uncertain. FSRN's Severin Bardon reports from Taipei.
It was the last day of campaign in Taiwan's presidential elections, and as usual, large political rallies were held in Taipei on Friday evening. Tens of thousands of supporters from both parties gathered in separate parts of the capital city and voiced their convictions after weeks of a rather fierce campaign. On the KMT side, the opposition party that is seen as the front runner for these elections, supporters insisted on the reliable personality of their candidate, Ma Ying-jeou.
He gives us a sense of security. He gives Taiwan stability. These past 8 years, Taiwanese people have suffered so much.
This is very good chairman. This Ma Ying-jeou, very good chairman.
During his campaign, Ma Ying-jeou has been insisting on his economic program, pledging to offer Taiwan a 6% economic growth in the coming years. On the Democratic Progressive Party side, the party of current president Chen Shui-bian, the emphasis was put on the protection of Taiwanese identity.
He's the only guy who can make sure that we maintain our Taiwanese identity over the past 50 years. The KMT, they've been ruling us, and I remember when I was a kid, when I was 6 years old, they kept on feeding us with all these Chinese history, and the stuff that we learned when I was a kid, it's all about China. I don't know anything about my country. The only thing I know is about China. But ever since our DPP president, Chen Shui-bian, who took control in 2000, everything has changed. He really gave us that Taiwanese identity. He really gave us a global position.
Tomorrow, the future of the island's relations with China will also be on the mind of every Taiwanese. Ma Ying-jeou, who favors closer links with China, proposed the creation of a common market with mainland China to support Taiwan's economy. But this suggestion has been widely criticized by the DPP's candidate, Frank Xie, whose program is much more cautious towards China. Even though Frank Xie is more moderate than the current president, Chen Shui-bian, the DPP still considers China a threat and a hurdle in Taiwan's international recognition. The repression in Tibet has been used as a powerful argument to emphasize the dangers China might represent for Taiwan. A last-minute plea on behalf of the Democratic Party, voiced by Xiaobi Kim, DPP's campaign spokeswoman.
You know, it reminds a lot of Taiwanese of the old days, where the Taiwanese language was also discriminated here in our own homeland, where it was banned from TV and from schools when people felt discriminated. It's a painful reminder about what could go wrong from the perspective of human rights and the struggle for democracy. You know, Tibet is a very brutal warning to the Taiwanese people, the danger of accepting one China, of getting too close to China.
After 8 years of DPP's presidency, Ma Ying-jeou used to have a comfortable advance in the polls, but the last few days have been tough on him and the gap seems to have narrowed, as explains Wu Kunyong, a professor of political sociology in Taiwan's community university. A large part of the electorate will take its decision based on the candidate's personality.
Je pense qu'on est encore très sous l'influence de la culture politique chinoise et américaine.
I think the Taiwanese democracy is still under the influence of Chinese and American political culture. This means we tend to choose a candidate for his moral and personal values. Unfortunately, we are still a young democracy, and the political debate on political issues is still not at the heart of the debate between the two candidates.
The outcome of tomorrow's election remains very hard to predict. The results will be known on Saturday night, Taiwan time. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Séverine Bardon in Taipei.
Wave of transatlantic security measures, the United States and Germany have agreed to share data like fingerprints and DNA in what they say is a move to prevent terrorist attacks and to combat organized crime. In international criminal investigations, data is currently shared on a case-by-case basis by official legal request. Under the new system of data exchange, each country can send fingerprints to be cross-referenced with the other's database. If there's a match or hit, the querying country must then make a legal request for further identifying data. But this latest agreement has once again provoked debate about personal privacy and infringement of civil liberties in the face of heightened surveillance. FSRN's Cinnamon Napard has more from Berlin.
This agreement comes hot on the heels of the airline passenger data sharing deal the United States struck with the EU, as well as US intelligence involvement in the arrest of three German terror suspects late last year. Speaking to Deutsche Welle, German Interior Minister Wolfgang Schäuble told a press conference that he viewed transnational information sharing as essential to fighting serious crime. The minister said the new agreement with the US was similar to one that already applies within the European Union. However, critics like Peter Schaar, Germany's Federal Commissioner for Privacy and Freedom of Information, say the agreement between the United States and Germany lacks independent supervision and accountability.
In Germany and in the European Prüm Treaty, we have a legal procedure of independent supervision by data protection authorities, like my office. There doesn't exist such an independent supervising authority in the United States. Second question is, could the data subject access the data concerned to him or to his or her data? There is no such right in the agreement between the US and Germany, but there is such a right in the Prüm Treaty. And third is the question, are those persons who are not Americans protected by the Privacy Act, the U.S. Privacy Act? So far as my information goes, the Privacy Act only covers U.S. citizens and foreigners who are residents, but no travelers and other people who don't live in the United States.
The fingerprints of more than 3 million people are currently recorded in German databases, from asylum seekers to Greenpeace activists, as well as people awaiting trial and, of course, convicted criminals. Under the new agreement, America can potentially access all this information. Because the United States records the fingerprints of all people entering its borders, Schaar is worried that cross-referencing this data may become a regular procedure and won't just be restricted to specific criminal investigations.
There will be a kind of transfer of personal data, because if the U.S. know who to whom the fingerprint belongs to, they know that this person is also recorded in a police database in Germany, and therefore it might be very interesting.
While proponents of the agreement were quick to say that data won't be stored if there's no suspicion, critics remain sceptical. Dr. Patricia Schneider from the Institute for Peace Research and Security Policy at the University of Hamburg.
That would be certainly better to have more cooperation between the intelligence services, for example, than just to collect data and exchanging data about millions of people without any suspicion beforehand.
Schneider questions whether this new agreement will in fact be successful in stopping terrorist attacks.
In preventing attacks, I see little proof of that. If we think of the World Trade Center attacks, for example, they could not have been prevented because about the people who did these attacks, there was no data given beforehand. So there were kind of, like we call them later, sleeper agents. There was no data about them because they were not criminal before. So if people who do these attacks are not in the system and their fingerprints and DNA are not in the system because they are not known criminals, then the whole prevention cannot take place through this means.
Since the attacks on the World Trade Center, London and Madrid, governments have toughened security measures and increased surveillance. But Peter Shah says that's not the only way to deal with this problem.
Well, I think there is a lot of symbolism in this debate. What could politicians do? They can prevent terrorism at the source, and they can ask for the reasons why innocent people or students become terrorists. That's the one way. The other way would be to fight against terrorism with surveillance, with police, with military actions. And I see that there is less effort focused on the prevention, on the basis of terrorism. And the consequence is that not only the freedom of the terrorists will be limited, but the freedom of all of us.
While the US works on securing similar bilateral agreements with other EU member states, in Germany the data sharing agreement must still be ratified by the German parliament before becoming law. However, the German government has come under fire from opposition parties because it did not inform the parliament before signing the agreement. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
The private investment firm 15 Group's proposal for the nation's largest redevelopment project, which threatens to displace some 6,000 mostly Latino residents, is in the works in the Boyle Heights neighborhood just east of downtown LA. Some 300 residents gathered this week in what they call the Mall, a large grassy field that's central to the complex, to inform themselves about the developer's plans and to strategize how to move forward. Nico Avinia has the story.
Miami-based 15 Group, which purchased the 70-acre Wivenwood apartment complex in 1998, says the $2 billion redevelopment plan will benefit the community. But not all residents agree. Miguel Angel Guerra has lived in the complex for 33 years.
The owner tells us one thing, but I believe it's all lies. He talks nice, but like the saying goes, there's a big difference between the word and the deed. I know the owner says he's going to charge $600 or $700, but I think it's going to be more like $2,000. But we as people need to unite the way we are doing right now so they don't make our lives a disaster. What they want is for the rich to get richer and the poor to get poorer.
The owner's proposed plan, which has yet to be submitted to the city for approval, will be the largest development project in the nation to date. It seeks to replace over 1,000 apartments with 4,500 new units. More than 3,000 of these apartments will be for sale. Stephen Fink is the executive vice president and principal of the 15 Group. He says that the proposal will allow residents the right to first refusal and will actually increase the amount of affordable housing because 15% of the units will be held as affordable housing per Los Angeles Housing Department standards.
By increasing the amount of affordable housing and creating an appropriate mixture of rental and for-sale housing, and providing more than 300,000 feet of neighborhood serving retail space, we should be able to improve the quality of life of our residents, welcome people back to the neighborhood that have moved out over the years, keep tax dollars and tax increment in the city of Los Angeles rather than losing it to other smaller cities, increase the employment within our community, all being done with a very creative relocation plan. We're very excited and, frankly, we're very proud of the efforts that we've made and the input that we've received from our tenants and the community as a whole.
Fink says he has met with about 30 community-based organizations, religious leaders, and schools in the Boyle Heights area and adds that he has received positive responses to the proposal. Yet some of the community groups, like East LA Community Corporation, a nonprofit that helps secure housing for low-income residents in Boyle Heights and unincorporated East LA, say they have yet to hear a plan that reflects the needs of current tenants. Isela Gracian is the group's director of community organizing.
We went to a meeting with them to hear about their plans, but we have not and will not endorse the project until it has concrete benefits for the tenants that are living there and the surrounding community. And we're taking a lead based on the tenants that are there. So we went to hear the plans and to see what they were doing, but they still have not discussed any concrete commitments to what the benefits are going to be there.
That likely means that developers from the 15 Group will have to do more work to convince the community that their proposal will benefit instead of displace residents. What some in the community worry about is the politicians who campaigned for their votes in the past elections may not support their interests now if the proposal goes to City Hall without residents' approval. Miguel Angel Guerra.
El Huizar y el Villarraigosa vinieron aquí a pedir nuestro voto. Se lo dimos.
City Council member Huizar and Mayor Villarraigosa came here to ask for our vote. We gave it to them, and what happened? They turned their backs on us, and that's bad on them, right? Because now, for my part, I won't vote for Villarraigosa for mayor again, and my family won't either.
Porque habla puras mentiras, ¿eh?
Because they speak pure lies. Instead of helping our people, he screws us over. He's threatening our people. Or maybe he's already changed, and now he has blue blood. Who knows?
According to Councilmember Jose Huizar's office, the politician has taken $5,000 in contributions from the 15 Group. Reporting from Boyle Heights in LA, I'm Nick Guaviña.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email at comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tina Gysi. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. Special thanks today to Matt Perez. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.